11. Illness. What makes us ill? How does illness spread? If humans evolved innate knowledge of any natural phenomenon, it should be disease. Avoiding disease is clearly advantageous from an evolutionary point of view, as pathogens and parasites threaten to stop our evolutionary lineage in its tracks. And sure enough, humans around the globe are repulsed by the kinds of things that contain pathogens and parasites. Bodily products, vomit, feces, bodily fluids, spit, sweat, violations of the body envelope, mutilation, gore, visible signs of infection, swelling, discoloration, parasites, ticks, maggots, and decomposing organic matter, rotten meat, spoiled milk. When we encounter such things, we make what is universally recognized as the disgust face, an expression characterized by a scrunched nose and an outthrust tongue. Both characteristics have practical benefits. The scrunched nose restricts our intake of contaminated air, and the outthrust tongue expels any contaminated substances from our mouth. Our repulsion toward noxious substances is mediated by an evolutionarily ancient part of our brain, the insular cortex. This part of our brain, which we share with all mammals, is a subcomponent of a larger neural system responsible for linking visceral sensations to conscious awareness. Curiously, the insular cortex becomes active not only when we feel disgusted, but when we see that others are disgusted, that others have scrunched their noses and thrust out their tongues. Disgust is thus triggered at a neural level both by first-hand identification of something noxious and by second-hand identification. Our brains operate on the assumption that anything that disgusts you should disgust me, which is sensible given that both of us are probably susceptible to the same diseases. Seeing someone look disgusted even bolsters our immune response. We produce more disease-fighting proteins in anticipation of coming into contact with a disease-ridden object. Disease-ridden objects are indeed core elicitors of disgust. They are universally regarded as disgusting. In one far-ranging study, researchers asked over 40,000 adults from all major continents to rate how disgusting they found each of the following objects: a mucus-covered plate, a pus-stained towel, a feverish-looking face, a congested subway car, a swarm of parasitic worms, and a louse. People everywhere rated these objects as more disgusting than perceptually similar objects that lacked cues to disease: a jelly-covered plate, an ink-stained towel, a healthy face, an empty subway car, a swarm of caterpillars, and a wasp. On average, women found the disease-ridden objects more disgusting than men did, and younger adults found the objects more disgusting than older adults did. But everyone found them at least somewhat disgusting, and thus somewhat aversive. The evolutionary logic behind disgust is seemingly straightforward, but it does have quirks. Consider the following situations: drinking a glass of spoiled milk, stepping in vomit, being sneezed on, getting a fishing hook stuck in your finger, touching the ashes of a cremated body, using your mouth to inflate a new, unlubricated condom, eating soup stirred with a sterilized fly swatter, eating fudge shaped like dog feces. Each of these situations typically elicits some degree of disgust, but the first four are qualitatively different from the last four. The first four entail a genuine threat of infection, whereas the last four do not. The last four are disgusting only by association, either perceptual association with a disease-ridden object, the feces-shaped fudge, functional association, the new condom, the sterilized fly swatter, or historical association, the ashes of a cremated body. The boundaries of disgust are readily extended to encompass substances that pose no real threat, because it's ultimately better to avoid something disease-neutral than to touch or ingest something disease-ridden. Avoiding a disease-neutral object is inconsequential from an evolutionary point of view, but exposure to a disease-ridden object can be a game-stopper. Our hypersensitivity toward the threat of contagion can be seen not just in our contemplation of hypothetical situations, but also in our actual behavior. Adults offered a piece of fudge in the shape of dog feces typically refuse it, even though they know perfectly well that the fudge is not contaminated. Adults offered juice stirred with a sterilized cockroach typically refuse to drink it, even though they know perfectly well that the juice has not been contaminated. Likewise, most adults refuse to hold a disc of plastic vomit between their teeth, eat soup out of a brand new bedpan, or eat sugar out of a bowl labeled cyanide, even when they themselves affixed the label to the bowl. Perhaps least rational of all, most adults refuse to eat soup from a bowl they have spit into or drink water from a glass they have spit into, even though they know that each bite of soup or each sip of water will mix with saliva the moment it hits their tongues. None of these activities are physically harmful, but they are still psychologically harmful. Our tendency to confer disgust by association would be nothing more than a quaint feature of human cognition if it weren't for our failure to associate disgust with many things that should be disgusting. For centuries, infectious diseases like cholera and smallpox spread like wildfire because humans were not disgusted by cholera-infested water or smallpox-infested blankets. These disease-ridden objects betrayed no sign of their deadly nature, so they spread disease more effectively than basic human-to-human contact. Even today, highly avoidable diseases like chlamydia and HIV still plague humanity because the acts that spread them are associated with pleasure rather than repulsion. Our evolved capacity to avoid pathogens and parasites, disgust, is thus largely ill-informed. On one hand, it's triggered by sights and sounds merely associated with disease, while on the other, it's left untriggered by the pathogens and parasites imbued in everyday objects. What disgusts us is not always a threat, and what threatens us is not always disgusting. Children are disgusted by many of the same things that adults are, as one would expect on an evolutionary account of disgust. They are not keen on smelling putrid odors or touching filthy socks, nor are they keen on holding a glass eyeball ostensibly plucked from someone's eye socket. But there are many aspects of children's disgust response that differ from adults. For starters, children below the age of 7 tend not to be disgusted by noxious things that lack the outward appearance of disease, like cockroaches, litter, or dead animals. Children also have a difficult time recognizing disgust in others. As late as age 8, they mistake expressions of disgust for expressions of anger. Their problem in identifying a scrunched nose and outthrust tongue as signs of disgust is not that they fail to understand the word disgust, they master that word by age 5, or that they fail to make disgust expressions themselves, they make those expressions from infancy. Rather, their problem is that anger and disgust share many similarities. Both are negatively charged, both are physiologically arousing, and both are associated with rejection and avoidance. Children thus assume that disgust is just a variant of anger. Perhaps the most significant difference in children's and adults' experience of disgust is children's lack of disgust toward objects that have been contaminated by external sources of disease. Anyone who has potty-trained a toddler or taught a toddler how to use a public restroom can attest to this fact. When my son Teddy became old enough to use the urinal, he was continually distracted by the bright pink urinal cake and often tried to pick it up. After I successfully dissuaded him from doing so, I had to dissuade him from grasping the sides of the urinal with his bare hands. I also had to dissuade him from pulling down his pants so far that they would soak up whatever liquid was pooled beneath the urinal. A fellow parent relayed to me an even more disgusting ordeal. Her 4-year-old was eager to use the public restroom by himself, but she was wary of letting him for fear of lurking pedophiles. One day, while shopping, she peered into the store's single-stall bathroom and verified that no one was inside. She then let her son use the bathroom by himself. He emerged a few minutes later with a grin of pride on his face. All seemed well until she noticed that he was chewing something, a wad of gum plucked from the bathroom wall. Children's disgust response, or lack thereof, has been systematically documented by psychologist Paul Rozin and his colleagues. In one of Rozin's studies, children between the ages of 4 and 12 were asked to entertain the following thought experiment. A grasshopper is washing himself in the lake. After he finishes, he hops into a house. In the house, a mother goes to the refrigerator and takes out the milk. She pours the milk. How much would you like to drink the milk? Children were shown an emoticon-based scale, ranging from a frowny face to a neutral face to a smiley face, and were asked to pick the face that best matched how they felt about drinking the milk. After they made their selection, the thought experiment continued. The grasshopper hops near the milk. How much would you like to drink the milk now? The grasshopper hops on the glass and falls in. He falls to the bottom. How much would you like to drink the milk now? The mother takes the grasshopper out. How much would you like to drink the milk now? The mother spills the milk. She pours new milk into the same glass. How much would you like to drink this new milk? She washes the glass with soap and water 3 times. She pours new milk into the same glass. How much would you like to drink this milk? At the start of the experiment, all children selected a smiley face to reflect their attitude toward drinking a fresh, uncontaminated glass of milk. After being told that a grasshopper fell into the milk, most then changed their selection to a frowny face. From that point onward, older children's responses differed markedly from younger children's. Older children, ages 8 and above, were not happy to drink the milk again until it had been poured out and the glass had been washed before it was refilled. Younger children, ages 6 and below, were happy to drink the milk as soon as the grasshopper had been fished out. The same result was found when grasshoppers were swapped for doggy dew. Older children said they would refuse to drink milk that doggy dew had fallen into until the glass had been washed and the milk had been replaced. But younger children said they would drink the milk as soon as the doggy dew had been fished out. Adults tested with the same materials typically expressed dissatisfaction with the milk even after the most extreme stage of decontamination, washing the glass and replacing the milk. Rozin and his colleagues worried that younger children may have responded differently from older children, not because their disgust response was less sensitive, but because their imaginations were less vivid. To circumvent this possibility, they performed a follow-up study in which they did away with hypothetical situations and presented children with real physical objects. They offered children foods that appeared to have been contaminated in one way or another. Juice stirred with a used comb, juice laden with a dead grasshopper, and cookies sprinkled with dried and ground-up grasshopper parts. None of these foods had actually been contaminated. The comb was sterilized, the dead grasshopper was sterilized, and the grasshopper powder was just green-colored streusel. But the children knew no better. And, consistent with previous studies, older children, ages 7 and above, refused to consume any of the foods on offer. But younger children, ages 6 and below, often accepted those foods. A whopping 77% of the younger children drank juice stirred with a used comb. 63% drank juice laden with a dead grasshopper, still floating inside. And 45% ate cookies powdered with grasshopper parts. Why do young children fail to be disgusted by incidental contamination? One possibility is that this form of disgust is a luxury afforded only to those who live in modern industrialized societies. For most of human history, anyone who refused to eat food prepared with non-sterile instruments would have starved, and anyone who refused to drink water that was not perfectly clear and odorless would have died of thirst. The same is true of anyone living in a developing country today. Indeed, the commonly held belief that food becomes inedible the moment it touches the ground is a luxury tenable only to those who have food to spare. Food picks up additional bacteria when it touches another surface, as do all objects. But the amount of bacteria depends on the type of food, the type of surface, the cleanliness of the surface, and the length of contact between the food and the surface. In most situations, eating something off the ground poses minimal risk of contagion, but many of us treat fallen food as if it were a deadly substance to be thrown directly into the trash. Another reason children's disgust response emerges so slowly is that this response has to be tailored to the local environment. The primary function of disgust is to defend our bodies from noxious substances, so disgust is always strongly linked to food. We willingly take food into our bodies, which is where pathogens and parasites would like to be. So disgust acts as a gatekeeper, helping us distinguish foods that are safe to ingest from foods that are not. For some species, evolution has pre-specified the food an animal will find disgusting, because those foods were a regular feature of the animal's ancestral environment. Ravens, for example, have a seemingly innate disgust of bees, which sting if consumed, and monarch butterflies, which induce nausea if consumed. Ravens do not need to learn through trial and error that bees sting and monarchs are nauseating. Evolution has endowed them with an automatic defense. Humans, on the other hand, have occupied and continue to occupy environments so distinct from one another that their food offerings overlap only minimally. Evolution could not have foreseen the food-based dangers present in all these varied environments. Humans must therefore discover for themselves which parts of the environment are safe to eat and which are not. The rule we seem to follow is that foods we encountered as children, provided to us by our caregivers, is safe to eat, whereas foods we did not encounter as children are not safe to eat. In this way, children growing up in coastal North America develop a taste for shellfish, served to them by their caregivers, but are disgusted by termites, not served by their caregivers. Whereas, children growing up in Central Africa develop a taste for termites, but are disgusted by shellfish. Termites and shellfish are all arthropods and are similar from a nutritional point of view. Yet we have strong feelings about which animals we are willing to eat and which we are not. When a food is unavailable during our childhood, we grow to regard it not merely as distasteful, but as disgusting, as outside the scope of human consumption. Across cultures, then, there are few consumable goods that are deemed universally disgusting. Ironically, Western researchers interested in the development of disgust have used grasshoppers as their stimuli. Grasshoppers are a delicacy in China, Indonesia, Thailand, Japan, Mexico, and Uganda. Young children's willingness to eat grasshopper-infused cookies and drink grasshopper-infused beverages is counterintuitive only from an Anglo-European perspective. Disgust may be our strongest defense against infectious disease, disease caused by bacteria, viruses, fungi, or parasites, but there are other reasons people fall ill, and thus other facets to our conceptions of illness. Sometimes we fall ill from nutritional deficiencies, example, rickets, scurvy. Or we fall ill from genetic abnormalities, example, Huntington's disease, cystic fibrosis. And sometimes we fall ill from a combination of genetic and environmental factors, example, diabetes, heart disease, cancer. Medical science has classified the causes of most human maladies, but the taxonomy is a recent innovation. for most of human history, the dominant explanation for all maladies, microbial, nutritional, and genetic, was an imbalance in our internal fluids, or humors. Beginning with Hippocrates, physicians analyzed disease in terms of four primary humors: blood, the sanguine humor; phlegm, the phlegmatic humor; yellow bile, the choleric humor; and black bile, the melancholic humor. Each humor was associated with a different organ: blood with heart, phlegm with brain, yellow bile with liver, black bile with spleen. A different season: blood with spring, phlegm with winter, yellow bile with summer, black bile with autumn. And a different element of creation: blood with air, phlegm with water, yellow bile with fire, black bile with earth. Diseases were explained in terms of a humoral imbalance. Too much blood was thought to cause headaches. Too much phlegm, epilepsy. Too much yellow bile, fevers. And too much black bile, depression. The prescribed cure for such diseases was to relieve the body of excess humors by inducing vomiting, defecation, or bleeding. The last of these cures, bloodletting, is particularly strange from a modern point of view. Bloodletting is a universal practice, observed in societies on all major continents, yet it invariably does more harm than good. President George Washington actually died from bloodletting after nearly half his blood was drained from his body in an attempt to cure a respiratory illness. While modern doctors have occasionally embraced the use of leeches as a form of treatment, the animal's utility lies in the anticoagulant properties of their saliva, not in the actual bloodletting. Bloodletting was practiced by many as an attempt to restore balance to the humors. Humors were thought to become imbalanced for a number of reasons: heredity, poor diet, imprudent behavior, a change in weather, a change in dwelling, or bad air. Bad air, or miasma, was the most popular explanation for diseases spread by infection, like plague or cholera. In the minds of early doctors, the contagious nature of these diseases was overshadowed by the bad smells associated with them. Dying people do not smell great. Of course, bad air was not the cause of death and dying. Death and dying was the cause of the bad air. Malaria was also blamed on bad air. Malaria literally means bad air in Italian, but the disease's association with bad air is equally superfluous. Malaria was thought to be caused by inhaling swamp vapors, but it was actually caused by the mosquitoes that bred in those swamps. Despite its shortcomings, the humoral theory of disease remained popular for thousands of years, from antiquity to the mid-19th century. Its successor, germ theory, was slow in coming. As early as 1546, Italian physician Girolamo Frascatoro published a treatise in which he argued that even people with well-balanced humors can become ill through the contraction of imperceptible particles, termed seminaria, or seeds. Frascatoro's notion of seeds was an improvement over humors, as it emphasized the role of contagion, but Frascatoro did not conceptualize seeds as biological. Over a century later, in 1676, the Dutch scientist Antony van Leeuwenhoek observed bacteria under a microscope for the first time, bacteria scraped from his teeth. Leeuwenhoek labeled what he saw animalcules, or tiny animals, but he did not link them to disease. The first person to make this link was the French scientist Louis Pasteur, nearly 200 years later, in 1857. Pasteur had been investigating the role of yeast in the fermentation of beer and wine and came to the realization that yeast is alive, that yeast is a microorganism that digests starch cells and leaves behind alcohol in their place. He then conjectured that the role of yeast in fermentation is similar to the role of germs in disease. the German scientist Robert Koch further developed Pasteur's ideas into a set of empirical predictions, which he and Pasteur later confirmed in experiments with anthrax and rabies. The result was not only a new theory of disease, germ theory, but also a new field of biology, microbiology. Today, the concept of a germ has permeated popular consciousness and popular discourse. Even toddlers are bombarded with messages about germs. Don't eat that, it has germs. Wash your hands with soap to kill all the germs. Cover your nose when you sneeze so you don't spread germs. All this talk about germs has affected the way young children think about illness. Preschoolers know that rotting food has germs and that eating rotting food can make you sick. They know that sick people have germs and that contact with a sick person can spread the sickness. They know that germs can be passed from contaminated objects, example a dead bug, to uncontaminated objects, example a glass of milk. And they know that germs are too small to be seen and can therefore be passed from one object to another undetected. But for all this factual knowledge, children are still willing to touch germ-contaminated objects and eat germ-contaminated foods, as discussed before. In one shocking demonstration of children's obliviousness to germs, researchers presented children with two bowls of cereal, a bowl that was clean and a bowl that someone appeared to sneeze into. Preschoolers ate as much cereal from the second bowl as the first, and they rated both bowls as equally yummy. Children's factual knowledge of germs clearly has limitations. Indeed, it's presumptuous to think that preschoolers have acquired a germ theory of disease from casual exposure to germ-related talk when it took scientists hundreds of years to discover germ theory. The notion of contagion may be easy to understand, but the notion of a germ is not. To children, germs are just a label for something that makes you sick. They have no idea that germs are different from other noxious substances, pesticides, disinfectants, toxic fumes, heavy metals, pollution, let alone that germs are alive. This point was nicely demonstrated in a study comparing children's understanding of germs to their understanding of poison. In the first part of the study, children between the ages of 4 and 10 were asked questions like this. A girl named Susan accidentally breathed in some germs and got a runny nose. If a friend came over to visit, do you think the friend could catch a runny nose from Susan? A boy named Sid breathed in some poison, and pretty soon he got a bad cough. If a friend came over to visit, do you think the friend could catch having a cough from Sid? In the second part of the study, children were asked whether germs eat, reproduce, and move on their own, and whether poisons eat, reproduce, and move on their own. Across both parts of the study, children below the age of 10 did not distinguish between germs and poison. They claimed that poison-induced illnesses were as contagious as germ-induced ones, and they claimed that neither poison nor germs have any biological properties. 10-year-olds, on the other hand, correctly claim that germ-induced illnesses are more contagious than poison-induced ones and correctly attributed biological properties to germs but not to poison. Still, the overall proportion of biological properties attributed to germs was small, about half, the same amount attributed to plants, which is consistent with the development patterns discussed in Chapter 8. Another study that drives home this same point looked at children's understanding of the differences between diseases caused by germs and those caused by genetics. The children in this study were asked to consider an illness-based version of the adoption scenario described in chapters 9 and 10. Mr. and Mrs. Robinson had a baby girl. That means that the baby came out of Mrs. Robinson's tummy. Right after she came out of Mrs. Robinson's tummy, the baby went to live with Mr. and Mrs. Jones. They named her Elizabeth. Elizabeth lived with them, and they took care of her. They fed her, bought her clothes, hugged her, and kissed her when she was sad. Mr. and Mrs. Robinson have trouble seeing certain colors. They cannot see the color yellow. Mr. and Mrs. Jones don't have any trouble seeing colors. They can see the color yellow. What do you think will happen to Elizabeth when she grows up? Will she be able to see the color yellow like Mr. and Mrs. Jones? Or will she be unable to see the color yellow like Mr. and Mrs. Robinson? Some of the adoption scenarios described genetic disorders, like color blindness. Others described infectious diseases, like the flu. Children below the age of 10 did not robustly differentiate the two types of conditions, claiming instead that both were attributable to the birth parents. That is, the children claimed not only that Elizabeth is likely to be colorblind if her birth parents are colorblind, but also that Elizabeth is likely to have the flu if her birth parents have the flu. If children understand that infectious diseases are transmitted through contact, that is, through the physical transfer of germs, then they should attribute such diseases to Elizabeth only when her adopted parents have them. But children rarely cited Elizabeth's adopted parents as the determinants of her current health. They seemed to think that infectious diseases, like genetic disorders, are inherited at birth. Clearly, the link between germs and disease is fuzzy in young children's minds. The link between germs and disease is fuzzy in adults' minds, too. Consider the common belief that you can catch a cold from being cold. Adults in both Eastern cultures and Western cultures hold this belief, prescribing heavy coats, thick scarves, and dry socks as ways of warding off illness. But merely being cold does not increase your chances of contracting a cold. Immunologists have found no correlation between coldness and illness across a century's worth of studies. The idea that you can catch your death of cold is just an old wives' tale, or, in the parlance of psychologists, a folk belief. Folk beliefs like these are appealing because they prescribe preventative measures without requiring any underlying knowledge of disease transmission. Anyone can obey the advice of staying warm and keeping dry, regardless of whether they think that diseases are caused by germs or by humors. But folk beliefs are often wrong, and the behaviors they spawn are often maladaptive. Causal knowledge of disease is the only surefire means of staying healthy. Psychologist Terry Kitfong Aw and her colleagues have demonstrated as much in studies of knowledge-focused health education programs. Drawing on the findings described before, they developed a health education program designed to teach the causal principles behind cold and flu prevention and dubbed the program Think Biology. Whereas conventional health education programs focus on behavior, the do's and don'ts of cold and flu prevention, the Think Biology program focused on knowledge, the whys and hows of cold and flu prevention. Its main objective was to get students to conceptualize germs as living, reproducing biological agents rather than as inert substances like poison. It emphasized four key principles. 1. That viruses are tiny living things too small to see with the naked eye. 2. That cold and flu viruses can survive for several hours in cool, humid air, but are quickly killed by heat and disinfectants. 3. That only live strains of virus can cause colds and flu. And 4. That cold and flu viruses enter the body through the eyes, nose, and mouth. To test the effectiveness of the Think Biology program, Aw administered it to a group of third graders in Hong Kong. She compared their progress with third graders who received a more conventional health education program. The conventional program did not cover any of the biological underpinning of cold and flu infection, but instead covered cold and flu symptoms, treatments, complications, preventative behaviors, do's, and risk behaviors, don'ts. Before and after each program, children's understanding of cold and flu infection was assessed by three tasks. The first was to describe behaviors that would cause people to catch a cold or flu and to explain why. The second was to watch videos of everyday situations and identify the events that posed a risk of cold and flu infection, such as rubbing one's eyes, chewing one's fingernails, or handing someone an eraser after having sneezed on it. The third task was more subtle. Each child was called into a room separate from the main classroom and asked to help put crackers into plastic bags for snack time. The crackers and bags were located on a table next to a bottle of hand sanitizer, and the measure of interest was whether children spontaneously used the hand sanitizer to clean their hands before touching the crackers. At the conclusion of the study, children in both health education programs were better able to explain illness in terms of germ transfer. Only children in the Think Biology program, however, could explain why germ transfer was harmful. That is, because germs, once transferred, replicate inside their new host. And only children in the Think Biology program were less likely to cite cold weather or wet weather as causes of cold and flu infection. When it came to identifying cold and flu risk behaviors, children in the conventional program could identify the risk factors they had studied, example being sneezed on, but they were unable to identify risk factors they had not studied, example, sharing a drink with a friend. Children in the Think Biology program, on the other hand, identified both studied and unstudied risk factors. Most significantly, only children in the Think Biology program increased their use of hand sanitizer when handling food. Rates of hand sanitation more than doubled, with 15% of students sanitizing their hands before the program and 41% sanitizing their hands after the program. Awe and her colleagues achieved similar success with a program designed to teach adolescents about the biological underpinnings of sexually transmitted diseases. The power of such programs lies not just in their ability to engender more accurate reasoning about infectious disease, but in their ability to engender more flexible reasoning. No health education program could cover all behaviors associated with the spread of a particular disease, and even if it could, no student is likely to memorize that list. An effective program provides students with the conceptual tools to evaluate risk in the moment as new disease-relevant situations unfold. As a case in point, Awe and her colleagues observed a curious breakdown in disease prevention behavior in the Hong Kong schools where they tested their cold and flu prevention program. The children in this school washed their hands dutifully before lunch, only to recontaminate them minutes later by touching the face masks they wore as a precaution against the 2003 outbreak of severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS. These face masks were the most contaminated objects in the children's environment, as they were covered in microbes filtered from the children's airstream throughout the day. Don't touch your face masks was not a rule covered in the school's conventional cold and flu prevention program, but it was a rule that could be inferred from the general principles covered by the Think Biology program. In fact, many children did infer this rule, labeling the touching of face masks as a risk factor in the risk factor identification task administered at the conclusion of the Think Biology program. In Awe's studies, children who learned about the microbial nature of colds and flu stopped citing cold weather and wet weather as causes of infectious disease. But other folk beliefs about the causes of infectious diseases are not so easily shaken. Folk beliefs of a supernatural flavor. Illness raises concerns that extend beyond the realm of secular affairs into the realm of gods, angels, ancestors, and spirits. For Christians and Jews, reprieve from illness is one of the most common forms of petitionary prayer. Christians and Jews seek God's help even in coping with infectious disease, like hepatitis or pneumonia. They do so not because they are unaware that infectious diseases are caused by germs, but because they view God and germs as complementary. God is the distal agent of human health, and germs are the proximal agent. Put differently, God is the answer to the question of why we fall ill, and germs are the answer to the question of how we fall ill. From our Western point of view, petitioning God for help with illness seems perfectly benign, but we are less complacent about the supernatural beliefs observed in other cultures, like the Creole belief that tuberculosis is caused by sorcery, the Hmong belief that epilepsy is caused by spirit possession, or the African belief that AIDS is caused by witchcraft. Those beliefs strike many Westerners as foolish. Yet psychologists have found that such beliefs take the same form and function as the Judeo-Christian belief that God has a hand in human health. Consider the folk belief that AIDS is caused by witchcraft. Healthcare workers have spent a significant amount of effort trying to dissuade Africans from this belief, on the assumption that it blocks their receptivity to scientific information about AIDS, the disease, and HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. But most African adults, and even many African children, know the basic facts about HIV. They know that HIV is passed through sexual contact or contact with blood, that HIV is not passed through skin-to-skin contact, that someone who is a carrier for HIV may not show any symptoms of AIDS, and that AIDS causes people to become thin and weak, but that being thin and weak does not cause people to get AIDS. On top of this knowledge, they also happen to believe that AIDS is caused by witchcraft, witchcraft wrought either by jealous neighbors or displeased ancestors. When asked to explain how AIDS could be caused both by a virus and by witchcraft, African adults provide several causally sophisticated explanations, like the following. Witchcraft can fool you into sleeping with an infected person. A witch can make a condom weak and break. The people that hated her paid the witches to put the virus in her path. He was bewitched and sleeping with infected people. Witches can use anything to kill you, evil magic, or HIV. Beliefs about witchcraft and viruses are intermingled in the minds of many Africans. Indeed, the two appear to develop hand in hand. Supernatural beliefs about HIV infection emerge only after children have acquired a biological understanding of the topic. It's not biologically naive children who point to witches as the cause of AIDS. It's adults. A similar developmental pattern has been observed in India and Vietnam as well. Many adults in these countries endorse a mixture of biological and supernatural explanations for illness. But the children raised in these countries endorse biological explanations before they endorse supernatural ones. Even in the United States, children are less likely than adults to endorse supernatural beliefs about illness, particularly the belief that illness is caused by immoral behavior. Disease obeys no moral laws. It afflicts the righteous as often as it afflicts the wicked. Yet many adults, even college-educated ones, believe otherwise. Consider the following vignette from a study on children's and adults' beliefs about the moral underpinnings of illness. Peter and Mark were talking about a person who just came down with a mysterious and deadly illness. The person led a healthy life, and there was no known reason why this person should have contracted the illness. Peter said, "I know that bad things happen to both good and bad people, but I believe there is a greater chance of bad things happening to bad people. This person was not a good person. He has cheated and lied and has robbed many decent people of their money. What goes around comes around." Mark said, "I disagree. People who are bad get serious illnesses just as often as people who are good. What goes around doesn't come around." When 12-year-old children heard this vignette and were asked who they agreed with, "Disease is random, Mark," or "Disease is deserved, Peter," 80% sided with Mark and 20% sided with Peter. When adults heard the same vignette, 60% sided with Mark and 40% sided with Peter. In other words, adults were twice as likely as children to blame the ill character for his own illness. These findings echo the popular belief among adults that cancer victims have caused their own cancer. Cancer looms as large in the minds of Americans as HIV in the minds of Africans, and no healthcare topic aside from vaccination seems to have attracted the same level of anti-intellectualism. quackery about cancer abounds on the internet, in self-help books, and on talk shows, perpetuating myths both about the causes of cancer, sugar, citrus, fungi, modern living, negative thinking, and its cures, cannabis, baking soda, ginger, meditation, coffee enemas. Adults may know more about disease and disease transmission than children do, but knowing how we got sick does not answer the question of why we got sick. And adults are universally bothered by this second question. It haunts us when we confront illness in ourselves or in our loved ones, and it causes us to turn from the realm of science to the realm of the supernatural. People across cultures are compelled to seek explanations that transcend mere happenstance, regardless of their biological knowledge. Blaming one's illness on a jealous witch or a vengeful god is sometimes better than having no one to blame at all.